Off the Ball Rugby.
You know, and in that coffee in Melbourne, Joe did say that, you know, stay fit. If something happens, you know, we may need you. And I thought, yeah, no chance that's happening, mate.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Final One Standing by William Hill on Off the Ball. Download the app and play today. 18+ gamblingcare.ie.
Welcome along. It is the Final One Standing here in Off the Ball. Only half of us left in the Off the Ball group. Currently, the Final One Standing in Off the Ball brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. Over 18s only. See gamblingcare.ie. So we have our game every week where we pick a team to win. You can only pick a team once. Half of the players in the Off the Ball League on the William Hill side are gone. I was on this show last week with Jer and David, both of whom were very confident, chest out, bragging almost, and both of them are gone. Jer predicted Man City to beat Spurs. David predicted Sunderland to beat Burnley, and neither of those things happened. So we're delighted to have on the show in the studio with me, Ben Symes. Ben, how are things?
All good, Shane. How are you?
And we have on the line, I'm all good, thank you very much. On the line we have Mick McCarthy and Cian Fahey. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, lads.
Is that an omen you're setting up there that the lads were on last week and they're gone and now we're on this week and you're trying to get rid of the competition here?
Whoever's here
are
with me.
Are we all still in?
Yeah, well, I think we're all still in. All of us on this call are still in. Yeah, so that bodes well. Mick, you've got a nice background there. Is that Villa Park behind you potentially?
It is indeed, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's excellent. Seemingly a graphic image. I don't know. I got it 2 seconds before we started the call, but, you know, it's there.
Yeah, it is a photograph.
And that's just me not giving up hope, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Hold on to it. Hold on to it. While we're here, we'll get to Lee Phillips in just a second, but maybe bring up the graph for who has picked whom this current weekend. So, Ben, you have opted for Manchester City.
Yeah. I think Forrest was the kind of shout screaming out of me this weekend, but I couldn't pick Forrest with my own
you're a West Ham
mind
fan.
As a West Ham fan. And then Chelsea, as you can see, four of our colleagues picked them as well. There's something about those early kickoffs on a Saturday. You never ever know what's going to happen. Jair got knocked out. City, you know, I know Spurs have a good record against Manchester City, but you just never know. And in a derby,
you're thinking they're not going to lose two weekends in a row, City, essentially.
I don't think City will. And Brighton, I watched them last weekend against Everton. I wasn't overly impressed. I know obviously it's away, it's at Everton's new stadium. It's going to be a tough game, first game there. But I wasn't overly impressed, and I think that City will have to bounce back from the loss last weekend.
Mm-hmm. Cian, you've gone for Nottingham Forest, and Mick, you've gone for Chelsea. I'll get your views on those in just a second. So it's Owen, Nathan, Mick and Eve with Chelsea. Cian and Matthew for Nottingham Forest, and I've gone for Manchester United. I'll just slip that in there and say no more until later on into the show. Lee Phelps, let's bring you in. How are things?
Yeah, really good, thank you. It's interesting how I was going to ask you guys, like, starting to hear from people who are like, oh, I can't use Arsenal or whatever, you know. Have any of you got looked at a pick so far and thought, oh, I've used them already, can't use them?
Hasn't happened just yet. It's going to get to that stage, you know, where people have used the big guns. But I guess there's tactics involved in this, Lee. There's pros and cons to using the big guys early, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I'm with Chelsea this week. You know, it's I went with Tottenham, went with Arsenal. I think Chelsea. I get the 12:30 thing, but I've watched Fulham. I've watched both games that Fulham have played so far, and they're just Fulham. You know, they're all right. You know, and they come on strong in the last 10-15 minutes, but I just think by then Chelsea might just be a couple of goals ahead and too far ahead of them. Fulham allow the opponents lots of shots on goal. And I think Chelsea are much more clinical than Fulham's previous two opponents, Brighton and Manchester United. So, yeah, I think Chelsea decent. There's about 20% or just under 20% have gone for Chelsea. The story of the week, really, with Final One Standing is Manchester United, as it is with across most of the footballing world. They were accounting day by day for 43.2% of the picks on Tuesday. They're now down to 22.1% of the picks after that performance at Grimsby on Wednesday night in the cup. So yeah, people have lost faith, and obviously you can edit your pick right up until 12:30 Saturday. That's the deadline to get your picks in, whether you're playing a half a million euro game or the 50 €1,000 game or a private league. It's 12:30 Saturday is the absolute deadline. If you don't get your pick in, you're gone. So you can change it, and I wonder how many more people will change between now and then. City, interestingly, they're so the friendless in the market, really. They're, like, I think 3.5% have gone with City this week. I agree, though. I think that I think that's a decent bet. You know, if you're looking at it as a single or putting it in an acca, I think they're underpriced. I think they should be shorter than they are going to Brighton.
Liverpool Arsenal, presumably, obviously the big game of the weekend, Lee, but presumably yeah. Most people avoiding it in the final one standing sense.
Yeah, 0.6% of players picking Liverpool, 0.1% picking Arsenal. I mean, Arsenal have been used, I remember, so I think Arsenal probably for a lot of people are gone. Liverpool still, you know, if you're playing the main game, then you've still got Liverpool up your sleeve for a lot of people. And I think that game against Burnley, when they come back from the international break, we'll see a huge amount going for them for that one. If you get knocked out, by the way, there's new jackpots being released all the time, and I'm not allowed to tell you any more detail than this, but there's during the international break, there'll be another big jackpot being launched as well. So if you get knocked out, or if you haven't played so far and you want to get involved, then, you know, keep an eye out on the app. Some of the others, maybe not surprisingly, but Nottingham Forest account for 20% of all picks this week, which like they were on my shortlist, if I'm being honest. I think you know there's no reason, you know, why, you know, they shouldn't win at home against West Ham. West Ham obviously have been in all sorts of bother. You know, Graham Potter, favourite to be the first manager to lose his job, and Forrester got a decent record against them. Callum Hudson-Odoi, by the way, has got 2-2 at the City Ground against them. Already scored this season, so yeah. And West Ham, they allow, a bit like Fulham, they allow a lot of shots on their goal. 41 shots they've allowed on goal, 17 on target. That's across three games, Cup and League. Chris Wood is one of the most prolific in front of goal and most clinical. He's averaging a goal every two shots this season, and he averaged 1 in 3 last Premier League season. So if West Ham allow Chris Wood 3 shots on goal, then chances are he's going to score at least one of them. So yeah, I think that's an interesting one. Nottingham Forest, and not many people will have used them so far.
Anything else you're looking at, Lee? Obviously, the promoted teams like doing fairly well, maybe above expectations so far. Sunderland home to Brentford, as we said. Burnley are away at Old Trafford, and Leeds home to Newcastle. That's a cracking game at 5:30 tomorrow, Saturday.
Yeah, maybe I'm losing my senses a little bit here. I'm not too keen on Sunderland. I think that could be a draw. I think Leeds are worth a look at home. They're not a big enough price for me, really. But I think Newcastle are beleaguered. I know they've made a signing. They've got a new striker in. Whether he plays this soon. But you know, if the injuries that we're told about, these players aren't available or aren't fully match fit, the likes of Fabian Schär, obviously missing Gordon through suspension. Obviously he's not playing as well. I think there's a lot of players out of their team who account for shots on target. They haven't been great in front of goal so far this season. I know they got 2 against Liverpool. That was kind of a crazy game. But I just think, you know, no Joe Linton, no Tonali potentially, no Schär. You know, those three players with Gordon as well have accounted for 16 of their 26 shots so far this season. So no goals, Leeds at home, great crowd. I just wonder if Leeds could maybe squeak out a 1-0 win or maybe something like that there. But and as for Burnley at Man United, I mean, you know, they drew their 1-1 in 24 last time they went to Old Trafford. Man United aren't scoring goals, as we've seen. They start really well and then just seem to drift away. If Burnley can recreate some of that championship defensive spirit that they had last season, I think they'll be going there, setting up for a draw and hoping they can take one away. You know, the draw's a decent enough price. But yeah, so it'd be a big result for Burnley, and it'd be a shocker for Ruben Amorim, whose price we saw crash through the floor during the week after that loss on penalties at Grimsby Town. So yeah, it's a fascinating weekend. We've got all the usual. We've got Acca Boosts, which you need 4 or more picks to activate. We've got Bet Builders. You've got a Bet Builder Bet and Get, and we've got loads of stuff going on the Liverpool Arsenal game as well, where you get money back as a free bet if your Bet Builder loses. So plenty of offers to have a look at all the way through the weekend, including your usual epic boosts as well.
Good stuff, Lee. Thank you very much for hopping on.
Good luck, guys.
Brilliant stuff, Lee Phelps from William Hill there. So the fixtures, just to bring people up to speed on the games they can look forward to across the weekend that we've mentioned. The early kickoff at 12:30 tomorrow, Saturday. Chelsea versus Fulham, the 3 o'clock games then. A rare 3 o'clock Saturday kickoff at Old Trafford, Manchester United versus Burnley. It is Sunderland against Brentford, Tottenham Hotspur home to Bournemouth, and Wolves against Everton at Molineux. Then, as we said, Leeds United versus Newcastle United at 5:30 tomorrow Saturday. Then on Sunday, four games to speak of. Two of those games live and exclusive commentaries on Off the Ball here on News Talk. Brighton versus Manchester City at 2 o'clock. We'll see Richie McCormack and Keith Tracy call that one. And then Liverpool versus Arsenal from Anfield at 4:30 will be Glenn Whelan alongside Stephen Doyle on commentary for that one. Nottingham Forest home to West Ham at 2 o'clock also. And in the evening game, Aston Villa versus Crystal Palace from 7 p.m. Mick, you've gone for Chelsea on that early Saturday kickoff, I think?
Yeah, it's no great sort of backing of Chelsea that I've gone for them. I suppose my philosophy on this, you talk about like David going for Sunderland last week and stuff like that, is like you have to stay in the game. You know what I mean? It's all very well trying to, you know, keep people for when you're in the last five, but you know, chances are you won't be in the last five unless you go for the teams that you think are going to win. So I've never won one of these, so I don't know what I'm talking about, but my philosophy has always been just try and stay in the game. So I just look at the fixtures and see who do I really fancy. And look, if I fancy two teams equally, I'm going to go for the, you know, I'll pick the lesser one so that I can keep the Liverpools or Chelsea's or City's or so for down the line. But this week I found it really difficult. And I suppose there's two reasons that I went for the pick I did. One of them is related to Manchester United and it was pre-Grimsby. But I just think where they were last season, I would never pick them in this game. Because I never know. It's not that they won't win games. It's that I never know when it'll be. You can never trust that they will play to the level that at least they think they are at. And you just wouldn't know what's going to happen. It'd be too, like, you'd be leaving them to your last five or six, like, genuinely, no matter who they're playing. And nothing has changed this season to suggest that it's going to be anything different, as obviously Tuesday night proved. And then the other thing is just Chelsea. I kind of fancied them at the start of the season. They were terrible in the first match, but I think Palace are going to frustrate a lot of teams this year and they're going to be a good side even without Eze. Now, they don't want to lose too many more over the next 2 days. But I know West Ham are a rabble, so I don't think we should read all that much into it, but I really liked the look of them the other night, last weekend. There's a... it was last Friday night, was it? God, it's time flying. And Estevao came in. I don't know if Palmer, how long he's going to be out for, but the Pedro and the Lap combination looked really good. Lap looks like a real, like, I don't know if he's going to score too many goals with Chelsea, but he is a very, very good link player. And Estevao comes in, Neto looks good. The shape of that team, the midfield is obviously superb, be it Fernandez as it is at the moment, or Lavia, if he, you know, when he starts coming in, obviously with Caicedo. Defence, they've got a good few to choose from, but they're solid there at the moment. I think they can probably get better. I think they'll bring in better, like, some of their better players will come back from injury as the season goes on. Just like the look of Chelsea, I can't see Fulham being that kind of decent team away from home causing them too many problems. I just can't. I think Palace are more equipped to play against the big teams, as we saw last season, the end of last season, so on, then Fulham are. And yeah, I just think they're the safest bet this week anyway. I do see Ben's point about the early kickoff and the general sort of throw out the form book element of that, but yeah, I wouldn't be overly concerned.
Yeah, Cian, I think Lee mentioned that it was something like 20% or over 20% of people have opted for Nottingham Forest at home to West Ham this weekend. One of those people is yourself. Confident they can get the job done, I suppose. At home advantage is big.
Yeah, I'm similar to Mick. Like, I use Liverpool in week one, Bournemouth in week two, and Nottingham Forest this week, because I'm just like, there's no point trying to outsmart this thing. Get your safe picks, get your safe, your biggest teams. Not saying anyone outside of Liverpool, they're our biggest team in the league, but they're all pretty big teams. Also, I'm only finding out right now that Ben is a West Ham fan, so I'm sorry about this, Ben. My strategy has been very complicated, and I've put lots of research into this, and my thought process is, if anyone is playing West Ham at home right now, that's a fairly safe bet. Like, I watched that Chelsea-West Ham game last week, and I thought Chelsea were fine, but realistically, West Ham got that goal ruled out for offside when they were about to go 2-1 up, and West Ham are an atrocious football team right now. The keeper there is an absolute disaster and was throwing the ball into his net, essentially, last week, which is half of why Chelsea were so good, as far as I can tell. So I'm not massively sold on Chelsea picking them. I feel like they were very poor in week one last week. They just blew away a bad football team. And I think this week they could beat Fulham. But Fulham, man, Fulham are always one of those, like, I feel like Fulham are quite boring as a club. So you tend to overlook them a little bit, but they're actually quite good as well. Like, I think they actually play better against Chelsea than they did against United, just because Chelsea will be a little bit more open, a little bit more like they're a better team than United, so they'll, and they're at home, so they'll come onto them more, which will allow Chelsea, or which will allow Fulham to hit them on the counter a little bit more than that. But no, I think I've general confidence in Forest as well. The one thing we haven't really mentioned here, of course, is that Mr. Marinakis's team over there and all the stuff going on with Nuno, it didn't seem to impact them that much last week. So my kind of concern would be that that does rear its head a little bit this week, and the team does start to show a little bit of praying. I know Mary Hutchinson has come in and they're not overly excited about what he did in his initial play. So I don't know. I'm confident about Forrest, but it's probably more so than anything a pick against West Ham and how bad West Ham have been. Sorry, yeah. Ben.
Can I
go ahead, Ben?
Can I bring us off topic for a second?
Dude,
just
please.
thinking about that Chelsea performance and whether you were sold. And I wonder, was I a little bit influenced by how exciting Estevao was? And I'm just wondering, like, if you take the whole idea of, like, maybe Max Downman coming into the Arsenal team on a more regular basis, Rio's impact on Monday night for Liverpool, has there been ever a collection of more exciting kids who could be, like, you know, we had Wayne Rooney, and it was like, oh, this is amazing, I can't believe there's a 16-year-old this good, and then you kind of, like, it happens once every 10 years, now it's kind of happening. You know, there's four or five of them at the same time.
I think you need to be 15 or 16 to impress me now. Estevao's 18, and I'm thinking he's a veteran.
Way too old.
He's way too old.
to make one of the best teams, to make the world champions.
Yeah, I know. The bar has been set quite high. But yeah, you look at these lads, like even Ajin Vuna for Shamrock Rovers, and it's just, they're getting younger, aren't they? Like, it's incredible.
Well, in the last, like, since Rooney, like, the only one that really stands out to me is Raheem Sterling. As like someone who came in as a proper child and was incredible. Is there anyone else? Like, it's a great point from Mick, really. Like Miles Lewis-Skelly and who's the other attacking midfielder at Arsenal right now, is escaping my mind. They're like old men at the moment. They're like old men at the moment, and they're like what, not even 20?
Yeah,
it's mad. It's great.
It's brilliant.
Marcus Rashford as well came in. Remember against Midtjylland?
Yeah, bench, was he 16, 17?
Yeah, and then he obviously scored against Arsenal that weekend as well.
Incredible.
Yeah. The interesting thing with the guys in the Premier League as well right now, though, like you see, Lamine Yamal is obviously the influence. When you look at Lamine Yamal, outside of like him looking kind of young with features and stuff, in terms of his body, he's built like an adult. He looks like an adult. Whereas like someone like Rio came on, and like, I noticed in the interview afterwards, it felt like you were looking at someone who was like going into his first day of secondary school. It did not look like you were looking at someone who was an actual proper adult yet, you know?
Yeah. And of course, Chelsea have signed another young prodigy, 21-year-old Alejandro Garnacho, heading to Stamford Bridge for 40 million. We'll see what he can do there. I don't know. Like, I just, as a lot of United fans will say, good riddance, essentially. It's not a signing.
Fourth youngest. Sorry,
go on ahead.
I interrupted there. Apologies. No, go on, Garnacho. Oh, I don't want to hear about the fourth youngest ever player.
I don't want to talk about Garnacho. So you can tell me all those stats.
Harvey Elliott,
right? Okay,
16 years and 30 days.
That was Fulham, wasn't it? Before he moved away.
Yeah.
It's good knowledge, Ben. Good knowledge. Yeah.
Nonieri is actually the youngest ever, which is so funny because you feel like he's been around for so long. He's still only 18.
Yeah,
I can't believe he was younger than Downman.
Yeah, I think Nonieri had literally kind of just turned 15. And they'd already put him into the first team down, but I think it's halfway through. But it's also an interesting point like to note that Arsenal are the ones that have produced both of the youngest players.
Mm.
Like obviously the Hayland Academy up there, like it's quite well known for young talent coming through. And obviously young talent that escapes, like you see the likes of Eze is now coming back. It's interesting to note that Arsenal have produced the two youngest.
Jesus, yeah. And I'm just trying to think of what I was doing at 15 or 16, and it certainly wasn't anything close. It would make you feel bad about yourself. But fair play.
I'm not letting you get away from Garnacho here, Shane. Did he get that 7-year contract that Chelsea always give players?
Yeah.
I heard he did. I wasn't sure.
It looks like a 7-year contract, all right, yeah. £40 million.
That seems like such a dangerous decision considering how his time at United went, because, like, he's not going to be quiet if things go the wrong way from him, are they? And like that, and there's all the stories about him being the guy who was leaking all the inside news and with his brother and all the stuff on Instagram and stuff like that. It seems like a massive risk on Chelsea's side, even though everyone's talking about how relatively cheap he is. Because I think, I know he's talented, but I also felt like he was kind of very raw, had some bit of moments, had some good goals. A bit of like, I'm not going to say he's Federico Makeda, but there's an element of that too. It's not like he's coming in and has proved himself to be this burgeoning star who just needs a good situation and he's going to thrive. I always felt like he was a ball stopper and someone who played for himself quite a lot, which is not unusual for a younger player, but I don't see the superstar talent or potential there. Now, maybe I'm completely wrong on that, and he'll be in with Chelsea's other 15 attacking midfielders who they all need to play with, and he'll be the star. I just don't see it happening.
The only thing on that, Don, it's taken me a while to come around, is that you do have to treat Chelsea as their own. They're on an island when it comes to the squad building, and they'll have inflated squads. They're not afraid of having a bomb squad. They're not afraid of sending people off. If Garnacho becomes an asshole 3 years into a 7-year contract and they can't get rid of him, they can kind of eat that. It doesn't pollute the dressing room the way it would at a United or at basically every other club, I would say. So Chelsea are well able to handle that. And I think as unproven as he is, as you're right, I kind of agree. I don't know which way it's going to go with Garnacho. I think it's a good bet at this price.
Yeah.
I have to say, I think if United had the idea that United fans or that the club would countenance losing him for 40 million a season and a half ago, I think they would have laughed. There's not a hope that's how they would have seen things going. I know they got Cole Palmer for 40 million, which is like the biggest steal in the world, but Cole Palmer was worth an awful lot more than that. You know, 40 million these days is a mid-level footballer.
I think Garnacho
has the potential to be more than that.
I'd probably be more sold on the upside with him if he was going somewhere where he was definitely going to play every week and he could actually play through his development. But like, he might play like off the bench 15 minutes, or he might just play a couple of games in Europe every so often. I don't think he's going to play every week.
Yeah.
Is he better than Nkunku, you know, from what we've seen Nkunku so far? I would say he is, you know. And so like, I think in that way, Chelsea have probably made money on this deal and probably improved their squad.
When you look at
they've lost 20 million selling Nkunku.
Yeah, they've lost the money on Nkunku, and then if you add Garnacho to it, they have Estevao, who is going to need to play. He just came brand new in, he's 18. You've Cole Palmer, who also likes to play on that right-hand side. I know they've played him through the middle recently, but we saw at West Ham last Friday, they played João Pedro on the 10 and then Delap in front of him. So Delap is going to want to play. João Pedro is going to want to play. Estevao has to play. Cole Palmer wants to play. Pedro Neto wants to play. Garnacho wants to play. You've Jamie Boyno-Gittens came in the door. He's also going to want to play. When they've played bigger teams, they've often played Enzo Fernandez actually up in that 10 position. So there's an argument here of, like, you know, does he play? Does he even play at all?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's so many players in those positions that he has to contend with to get into. Now, I know they're competing on a lot of fronts, and obviously he'll get minutes across all those competitions. But for a guy who we've known to kind of throw his toys out of the pram, if things aren't going his way, he's not exactly picked a club where he's got a clear slot into the starting 11 here.
Mm. Go on, make
every player. How are Chelsea going to fit Kobbie Mainoo in when they sign him tomorrow, Shane? You know,
I don't know where he's going to go.
That's left United, though, has, you know, you can't judge them by what they've been at Manchester United for the last few years.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
In terms of their petulant attitudes, in terms of what, and maybe that's the build up of the petulant people in the squads, but you go to a better situation where not everybody's like that. And I'm not entirely convinced that Chelsea are. But if it is a better situation, you know, the leaders in that dress, like that, that's what United have lacked. They've lacked strong leadership both on the pitch and off to get lads like this in line.
Yeah.
And turn them into better professionals. I still think all the raw talent is there with Garnacho.
It is. Look, he does have talent and a lot of it, but one thing's for sure, he'll not be there in 7 years. You know, a 28-year-old Alejandro Garnacho will not be playing for Chelsea in 7 years. That lad's going to bounce back and forth.
I mean, Raheem Sterling's still there at the moment, so he looks like he's going to stay for the long run, so maybe he will.
And you forget about him. You keep forgetting Sterling is there, to be honest. Mick, your beloved Aston Villa this weekend. How do you feel about that one? Because obviously it's a decent game. Obviously a 7 p.m. Sunday is a unique enough one, presumably because of the transfer deadline day at 7 p.m. on Monday. So Villa Palace 7 p.m. Sunday is a decent one.
It is, if you're a Palace fan, I think. There's been the FA Cup semi-final and the Selhurst Park game last season are the last two times they've played. They've scored 4 goals on both occasions and fairly hammered Villa. And they've been a really difficult team. Like, there was a stat up last week that I saw that... now, Ismaila Zaha has been playing well in general lately since the FA Cup semi-final where he destroyed Villa. But up until that point, he only scored goals against Aston Villa. He was Messi and Ronaldo turned into one whenever he played against one particular team, and then like a mediocre, borderline, not Premier League player the rest of the time. So you can expect him to fill his boots, and Mateta as well. Both those players are behind only Mo Salah as current Premier League players who've scored more goals against Aston Villa.
Right. Jeez.
So there you go. This is not a good fixture for Villa. Now, they've been okay. They drew with them at Villa Park last year in a game they should have won. And in general, I think have won five wins and two draws in the last 7 games between the two at Villa Park. Now, the bigger issue isn't history against Palace, it's, you know, the state of the team that started the season. I can understand frustration with the money. I can understand a bit of stagnation and maybe, you know, not all that, you know, they lost out in the Champions League badly on the last day of the season. I think people have underestimated, because people don't really talk about Villa, they've underestimated how hard that was and how, like, you know, they needed a point at home to a very, very poor Manchester United team and didn't get it. And I think that's been hard to live with. I think it's been a tough summer. And then the financial issues kind of became, they went from rumour to reality, and the squad hasn't got any stronger. And I think it's affected everybody at the club. But they need to pick it up pretty quickly, because they've been absolutely dreadful. Dreadful. I can't even begin to describe to anyone who hasn't seen the games how poor they've been, especially in attack. In two games, they haven't created a chance of note. You know, if you were picking like highlights of Match of the Day and you didn't feel like you had to throw in something from both teams, I don't think there would be a Villa highlight yet this season.
Mm. Can I ask you about that, actually? I watched the Newcastle game and it was astonishing to me. Everything's going on, all right, there's loads of issues with financial, there's no investment in the squad, all that kind of stuff. But the Newcastle game was just bizarre to see, because it's an Unai Emery team. You expect there to be a good structure. You expect there to be movement. And players were just standing still. Yeah. Throughout the whole, and like, when you have someone in particular like Morgan Rodgers in your team, we've seen him at his best, floating around, picking the ball up, driving at teams. Like, I remember the Man City either goal or assist he got last year or the year before. And it's like, this team is meant to be full of energy. It's meant to be full of, like, not necessarily creative player, but a bit like Liverpool when they were under Klopp, where it was like very structured, very intense, and very, like, there was enough creativity within it. And then that Newcastle game, I don't know if it got better last week. I didn't see last week's game. That Newcastle game, it looked like a team that just didn't exist for the last 3 years in Villa.
That's it. They should have more cohesion than nearly any other team in the Premier League. And that's the point I was going to get to, is like all this like dark cloud hanging over them, like, it's not really good enough. And John McGinn said as much after the Brentford game. He said, like, that's one thing. Our job is to go and do what we can. And we know that this group is good enough to be wherever the final placing will be an argument amongst the four of us, but we know they're better than this, and there's no real excuse for starting. And now Rodgers, you mentioned Rodgers' form, you know, again, didn't get a lot of coverage, but his form fell off a cliff at the end of last season, towards the end of the Champions League campaign, all the way to the end of the season. And you would expect, oh, he's had a rest over the summer, things will pick up. They haven't. His touch is deserting him. So all those things that you're saying about him coming and picking up the ball, he keeps doing that and then losing it, you know, which he just wasn't doing at all last year. So you hope that will turn around. They need some width in the team. Like, you know, you're playing John McGinn on the right at this stage, with Rodgers kind of on the left. Both are coming in. They need at least one winger. They've got rid of Bailey. You know, so I don't know. It doesn't look like Malin is up to it. So I don't really know where the change is coming from. You know, the new signing Gessen came on for his debut against Brentford, and like, he looked raw as hell, but he threw himself around the place and brought a bit of energy. And you're like, yeah, maybe we could have a look at this guy, you know, but that's not all. There's talk of Asensio coming in the next few days. You know, and there's mixed kind of reactions to that among Villa fans, and like, you're signing a, you know, maybe paying 20 million or so for a 29-year-old on the last year of his contract, but like, they need something. They need that bit of class. You know what I mean? It's not going to come from Emi Buendia at this stage. Like, so very, very worrying start. I wouldn't pick them in a million years in Final One Standing this year, this week, because I don't know where the goals are coming from. Palace, like, you know, Palace have a very good manager, and they're like, regardless of what players they lose and everything like that, this is a guy who has Villa a little bit figured out, from what I could see. I thought that a little bit after the Selhurst Park game last season, and then you watch the FA Cup final, which was probably Villa's worst performance of the season last year, but you were thinking a lot of it was to do with what Palace are doing. And again, I talked about them a good bit in the start of the season here. I think they're a very, very good side. They will miss Eze, but he's not the kind of player that will collapse the team either. Mm. You know, he's the kind of bit of magic for them. So they will miss him, I think, overall. But I don't think losing him will affect how they play or their level of, you know, how much they can dominate a game or anything like that.
Yeah, for sure. We should touch on Liverpool-Arsenal before we finish, of course. Anfield action. It's an interesting one, Ben. I'll see two teams who have impressed in different ways. Liverpool with the 4-2 win over Bournemouth, albeit some defensive issues in that one, and then managed to scrape the last minute winner courtesy of Rio the other night against Newcastle. And then Arsenal, yeah, not that impressive against United at Old Trafford in the first game, but then 5 stars for their performance against Leeds. So it's fascinating, this one on Sunday.
Yeah, in a Liverpool, from a Liverpool sense, I think going into these sorts of games this season, and from what I've seen of them in the last two games, I really think that they should revert back to the midfield three that played last season, and potentially that means dropping Florian Wirtz. So
big call.
It's a big call, but from what I've seen from the first two games, I'm not saying he won't get there,
and they won't, and they probably won't drop him either.
No, they probably won't drop him, and that's the thing, I suppose. But he hasn't looked up to it physically yet. Now, he can get there. He's brand new to the league, obviously, playing in the Bundesliga. It's a lot less physical. And he's looked tired. And when you're playing against a team, you know, a Rice Subamendi pivot in midfield, who, like, let's face it, is probably one of the better ones in the league. And last season, Liverpool's three was, you could argue, the best. It was definitely the most shocking in terms of how good they were. When you have a system that works so well, I don't know why they wouldn't just revert to that and keep the front three of Salah, Gakpo on the left and Ekitike up the middle, and drop Wirtz and play midfield three of McAllister, Szoboszlai and Gravenberch. When you're up against a midfield that's so strong in a game that's so important, it's in almost a way, it's a pity that this game's come so soon in the season. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see this in game week 8, 9, 10 when they've kind of built up a bit more steam and we know what these teams are really about. You said about Arsenal, like, they look so poor in the opening day,
yeah,
against Manchester United, who've gone on to be, it looks like it could be the one of the worst Manchester United teams I've ever seen anyway, and yet they bounce back against Leeds, and I know Leeds are just promoted, but they look so strong against Leeds. And this Liverpool team, who, you know, walked the league last season, and we kind of still don't really know what they're doing this season. So for a game of this magnitude and up against a midfield so strong, I would 100% drop Wirtz from the midfield three and revert back to what you have and what you know. And when you know can battle up against a midfield that's strong.
Kane, you're a Liverpool man.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one this weekend because they haven't had everyone available yet. Gravenberch was suspended for the first game. McAllister missed last week's game. I don't know what they're going to do, which is also why I'm kind of a little bit skeptical of why we're signing Isak, because once he's in, I don't know who the hell's going to play. I don't think you're going to be looking at dropping Ekitike at this stage because of how good he's been to start the year. The one thing I'll say in Wirtz's defence is the start they've had has not been easy at all. Like Bournemouth, Newcastle and Arsenal, like that's three really high intense games. That's really three good midfields you're going against. So I think he will eventually find his feet. And I know Ben said that as well, so I'm not saying that Ben slayed him or anything like that. But like my bigger concern with Liverpool is the defensive side. Like Kirk doesn't seem to know what he's doing. And I know he's been in the league. He's been effective. He played with Dean Huijsen last year, kind of covering for him. Van Dijk next to him, in theory, is better than Dean Huijsen. So I think it's probably more the fit and figuring out exactly what his role is. Similar situation at right back, although I think Conor Bradley should probably start this weekend to be back. So obviously it was actually quite amazing at right back against Newcastle. He made three or four very important clearances in the first half that have been a little bit forgotten to keep the game at nil all the time. So I think Liverpool are kind of a weird team because they won the league last year at a canter, didn't really change a team. And now we're changing so many parts that it's actually kind of a team in transition, which is very weird for a team that won a title three games ago. Like, there's a lot to figure out. And the way Slot's building the team, it feels like we're trying to move to wingbacks at some point because neither Frimpong or Kirkez are kind of proper fullbacks. And the way they've brought in Wirtz versus like a 10, we don't really play with a 10. You've had Szoboszlai in that role last year where it was more of a pressing 10 rather than a playmaker. So there's a lot for them to figure out. I think what makes this game kind of more interesting than I would have anticipated is with Saka out, you know, you have Madueke starting on the right more than likely, and then you've got Eze more than likely on the left. I kind of think Eze is not necessarily a perfect fit at Arsenal because Mikel Arteta loves defenders, loves a defensive conservative approach, generally goes into these games, puts 11 men behind the ball as much as he can. And Eze is, like, if you ever talk to Palace fans or look at Palace analysis of him, he's a free spirit, essentially. He's going to shoot as much as possible. He's going to try the difficult pass. And it's what makes him an effective footballer. But I don't feel like that's exactly what Arteta wants. Like, that's kind of why Odegaard has gone that direction. You look at Jack Grealish with Pep. I think it might be similar to that, where you take, like, the wild creative flair and you try and insert him into a team that's extremely rigid and extremely structured. And especially when Arteta keeps his wingers out on the touchline, which is definitely not his game. I wonder how that's going to work, and especially if they start him at Anfield for his debut. It's going to be a huge story one way or another, depending on how it goes. Now, maybe he doesn't start, but I think you kind of have to start him with Saka out.
Mick, how do you see this one going before we finish up?
Yeah, I personally think, given everything you've just said, I completely agree with you. I think he's going to start Trossard. I think he's going to go negative. I think both teams would probably be happy with a draw, but I just hope for Arsenal's sake that they go for it. I hope they start Eze. I hope that they try to win this game, because I think everything you said about Liverpool is true, and I don't think they're playing that well at the moment. They've got 6 points out of six and in two difficult games, and I think they'll get better. They are a team in transition, as Keane said, and I wouldn't drop Wirtz, because I think they've paid so much money on this guy. They genuinely believe in it. Both of you have said that you think he's going to come good. You have to persevere with him. You have to try and make that happen as quick as possible. A lot of the best players ever for teams, Dennis Bergkamp, for example, Thierry Henry, picking just two Arsenal examples randomly, have struggled at the start. They've taken a few games to get in. You want those games to happen as quick as possible. I think Liverpool need to, like, Liverpool have less to lose, even though it's their home game against Arsenal, funnily enough. I think that they have to, like, they're a team that have a month to settle into the season, and they've had a good start points-wise, if not performance-wise, right? So, for me, Arsenal should be coming to Anfield thinking, these are there for the taking. Let's go and lay down a marker and actually, you know, make ourselves the team to beat this season. I just worry that they'll be happy with a point. And obviously the game, it depends on how the game will go. I don't think they'll actually say those words. I just wonder if subconsciously that's the feeling. We're going to Anfield, we come away with a point, we're the ultimate victors. But the circumstance of the season would suggest that this might be a chance for them.
Well, what you're saying
I do
before...
Wonder, will, sorry, go on. Sorry, Ben. I do wonder, does Arteta look at this and think, oh, I have my same game plan that's worked before, where I get that solid setup, but now I have Gyökeres up front, and Konate has been a bit of a disaster to start this year. So maybe the whole plan will be, we'll sit back and we'll just put Gyökeres on Konate and play those long balls like he scored against Leeds, running in behind and then cut in and shot across the keeper. Maybe that'll be the game plan. Now, personally, like you, I think even for the long-term outlook for them, for their philosophy, for their approach over the rest of the season, you have to go here and not sit in. You have to go here and try and make a statement. But if they sneak a win that way, they won't complain, obviously, you know?
Yeah.
I think for Arsenal, and I guess it kind of encompasses Arteta's time there as a wider thing, I think like they have to properly push the league this season. And I don't think you can do that without going to these sides and trying to take, not necessarily take the game to them. You're going to Anfield, it's a very tough game. But to just sit in and, you know, hope to maybe nick one and let Liverpool dictate the game, like, he has to win a trophy this season. And you, like, when have you ever seen teams in the last 10 years win these trophies in the Premier League by going to these teams and sitting back and kind of hoping you might nick one on the counter?
Mm. Yeah, that's a go for it. Go for broke.
Can I say, Shane, you've gotten away with murder on this podcast. You should have done 25 or 30 minutes of Ben Hughes. What the hell?
That's all we have time for anyway.
But not a hope.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's been a week, I suppose. Yeah.
But a beaten man right there.
Well, United fans are fairly numb to this sort of thing over the last, what, decade maybe. But yeah, that felt like a particularly galling one. Just the fact that Amorim has become a bit of a meme, you know, sitting there with the tactics board and head in hands for the whole penalty shootout. And I don't know. And then even the post-match interview where he's saying, you know, the players spoke volumes out there. Like,
Do you think he wants to leave? I feel like even at the second half of last season, he was talking like someone who wanted to be fired.
I kind of feel sorry for him because he didn't want to be at United until the start of this season.
Like, yeah.
I think he saw this coming potentially. He maybe hoped they would not be quite as bad as they are, but that was a particularly galling low point to lose to Grimsby in that fight, but also to lose to Grimsby, who were far better than them across the game, particularly in the first 45 minutes. And they probably should have made a 3-0 as well. I don't know, was that goal really offside, the 3-0 win in off the post? So, I don't know. Look, it's funny because if United end up, say, for example, they beat Burnley 2 or 3-0 at home tomorrow and play quite well, which is tough to see at the moment, then all of a sudden, you know, they've lost to Arsenal in the opening game but played quite well. You know, disappointing draw with Fulham, but albeit a draw on the road, and then beating Burnley going into the international break. I don't know.
If Brentford, no, well, let's take Brentford out because they've got a new manager and so on. Say, if Bournemouth had that performance at home to Arsenal at the start of the season, where you're at home, Arsenal don't play too well, you put it up to them a little bit, but ultimately they've scored early, which changes the entire sense of the game anyway, and Arsenal comfortably enough hang on to win 1-0. Do you think anyone, including Bournemouth fans, would still be talking about that game?
I don't think so.
And I don't mean that in a harsh way. I don't mean that you've had a goal. I just feel that United are clinging on to this positive performance, but ultimately they were beaten at home And I think comfortably. I know that they had signs of like being able to dominate a game again, and which they hadn't seen in so long, but it wasn't a positive start to the season. It really wasn't, like, you know, not in the grand scheme of things, maybe by the clutching at straws. But if you don't back that up in your next two games, including against a League Two team, then I think we have to forget about it.
I think it was because it was the first game of the season and United fans hadn't seen a performance that gave them a little bit of hope. Maybe you could count them on one hand from last season. You could count them on a couple of fingers, maybe, the performances that gave United fans hope last season. To see it in an open, you know, and it's going to take a bit of time for the new signings to gel in, but every team's in that position, in fairness. Šeško's just off it. The goalkeeper situation would make a grown man cry. Like, Onana's not up to it, Bayindir's not up to it. We're talking about signing this guy Sandy Lammens from Antwerp. The whole thing is a bit of a mess, and Amorim seems to have, I don't know if he's lost the dressing room or if he just doesn't have faith in the players, but certainly those interviews after the game would suggest concerns behind the scenes, you know.
Well, you mentioned the goalkeeper. You mentioned the goalkeeper there. As watching that penalty shootout midweek, I've never in my life seen a goalkeeper get so many hands to the ball and not stop any of them. That was bizarre. I don't know how weak hand or soft handed he is. And then like the two goals, obviously not moving his feet for the first one, and then the corner. It's astonishing how bad a signing he's been, and it comes back to that recruitment aspect. But the recruitment, I don't think, has gotten better either. I think you've signed better players, and Mbeumo and Cunha are good players. But watching Mbeumo so far, I'm looking at him and going, he's in the position Ahmad should be in. And Ahmad is now playing right wing back for some reason, even though he's like your brightest prospect moving forward. And you have Bruno Fernandes, who's technically your best player still, playing out of position. That's the kind of stuff that drives me mad at Amorim, because I'm like, okay, I'll give you time. I watched Klopp go through all that stuff. We always kind of, you saw how bad Klopp scenes where he had Alberto Moreno there, and it was like, these mistakes are going to happen. You had these players who weren't good enough, but there was a clear identity of what they were doing. And Rim, like, I don't understand what he's even trying to do. Like, if everything worked the way it was supposed to work, it would still be bad, as far as I can tell.
If you look at this summer, they spent 229 million on three. Okay, they probably did need one forward, but it's three luxury positions. You spend 229 million on three fellas who, let's face it, they all want to do the same thing. They all want to score goals or create goals. You've no box-to-box midfielder. I still think they need another centre-half. As you said, the keeper situation is atrocious. Like, I don't get how he can look on that team, Amorim, look at his team from the back end of last season, and they've given him a war chest of 230 million. He's gone, I'm going to sign three forwards, and I'm not going to sign a box-to-box midfielder. I'm not going to sign a centre-half. And as we've seen, most crucially, I'm not going to sign a goalkeeper when his two goalkeepers, I don't think, would start for any other team in the league.
Yeah, but Ben, you have to, like, the fact that United have brought in this manager who has a rigid system and none of the players suit it, you know, already alarm bells. I'm not 100% sure he's the one who's making the decisions to bring in these players at all, you know, and like the whole point of an Amorim system is it needs to be players that suit him, but it's got players playing out of position, as Keane says. Like, the whole thing's a mess. My biggest question is, you know, I had a conversation with Arthur on the show, and I can't remember what the Ten Hag moment was. It might have been something to do in the Champions League. It was definitely the season before when they won the FA Cup, where it was like, you get to a point as a manager where enough things have happened that you become a kind of a figure of fun, like a clown figure almost. And I don't know if there's any way back from it. You know, like, I think, and sometimes it can be unfair, you know, like plenty of people, like Stephen Kenny had it at Ireland, you know, like is in, but like Ten Hag definitely had it. And even winning the FA Cup didn't save it. It saved his job and it made people argue about it. And maybe he is coming back. But as soon as anything happened the next year, he sort of knew, you just knew it was over. I don't know if Amorim can come back from Tuesday night. I really don't. I don't know how you turn around a sense of his interviews where he's so clearly lost the dressing room or given up on the dressing room. Maybe they've lost him, right? And the sitting in the rain, not watching the penalties. I don't understand that. Like, that just feels like what a absolute statement of I'm not in control, or I don't have any belief in this, or he's no calm about him, you know, like that's unbelievable. The tactics board thing, whatever, I'd be more forgiving of that, but ultimately that actually could be the thing that ends him, because that's the meme, you know, and that's so everything like that. I don't know how he ever, and it's not that he can't win fans around or something, I don't know if he can turn around Manchester United now. Because once you become that kind of figure of fun, you're dealing with awkward, rich, young millionaires who are looking for an excuse not to respect you.
Yeah.
Is this a wider...
Thomas Frank. Like, Thomas Frank has come in with that cam. He's also played completely different systems in his first couple of games and got great results. And he's dealing with Tottenham being laughed at over all the transfer stuff. And it's like, okay, it doesn't matter. We're just focused on getting results, playing as a good football team and doing that. That's the character you need. And they didn't have it with Ten Hag. They don't have it with Amorim's mixing.
Well, I think it could be a wider Manchester United problem where you talk about a manager becoming a clown aspect. We had it with David Moyes, and David Moyes went on to win a Conference League at West Ham. I know it kind of ended quite sour. He's gone to Everton and he's managed to turn that ship back around as well. Erik ten Hag, obviously, we're kind of yet to see what he's done after. But before he went to Manchester United, he was so highly rated at Ajax. Before Amorim went to Manchester United, he was so highly rated, albeit in Portugal. Is it just a Manchester United effect where... they turn
well,
these
it's the hardest job
clowns.
In the world. It's the biggest. It's probably the second hardest job in the world after Real Madrid, but maybe
England,
harder because they're not financially as supported and players want to leave and so on. But like that should be actually taken into account. But you know you have to wire it in a hiring the right guys. Ten Hag might be a good manager. Amorim, I think, probably will be a good manager. But they're not the personality types for a broken down team that need rebuilding from the bottom up. Like that's Jurgen Klopp. Like that's a personality thing. It's not a tactics thing. It's not a what formation do you play thing. And I know Klopp has all that too. But ultimately what he had was the ultimate respect of everybody in the dressing room. And that's like I honestly would rather they brought in a kind of a 4-4-2 Neanderthal, but that was someone that was able to kind of get a bit of sort of, you know, slap them in the back of the head kind of, you know, attitude. They don't have a leader, you know, and I just can't believe they've done it again.
The captain isn't a leader either, which doesn't help. Like that Fulham penalty
thing,
atrocious. How that happened last week and wasn't a huge story, I don't know.
Give it Dyche till the end of the season. Yeah, absolutely. And after
Big Burton, Sam.
Yeah. Well, look, he's been there 10 months, Amorim, and he hasn't put two league wins in a row together, which is...
29 points.
It's damning. Damning indictment. Is 28
yeah. and 29 games, yeah.
Shocking.
He has a worse win record than Gary Neville at Valencia. I saw that on Twitter last night.
That sums it up, I think. And then after
they'll
the international break, well, they should. And then they have Man City away, Chelsea at home, and Keith Andrews, Brentford away. So a few tough fixtures coming up in September as well for Manchester United. Any United fans out there, apologies. I did try to not get there in the conversation, but it was ultimately inevitable. Lads, thanks very much, Ben, Mick and Cian, for that on Final One Standing today. Final One Standing on Off The Ball is brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. Over 18s only. See gamblingcare.ie. We'll be back on Final One Standing next week. See you then. Good luck.
The Final One Standing by William Hill on Off The Ball. Download the app and play today. 18 plus gamblingcare.ie.